Good morning. So last time we talked a bit more about how synassociative hackers work, and we talked about parts besides just looking up values that were in the cache. So one issue we had to deal with was replacement policy. So with the redirect map cache, when you wanted to cache something, we had one place to put it. There were no real decisions to make. We just put it in that part of the cache. We were done. With a synassociative cache, we have extra flexibility that now we had multiple places we could put a block we got from memory. And we need to decide between them when that choice was meaningful. So like if one of the places to put it doesn't have anything and the other does, well, put it where there's not anything already. You know, that's obviously more efficient, but sometimes they'll both have something. And we need to make a decision. And we learned, well, we were assuming locality as sort of this principle for building caches, and there's a policy we can have which kind of makes the same assumption called least recently used, where we replace the block of our choices, which is going to be just everything in that row, that has been used least recently. And by used, I mean read or written least recently, where there's going to should be the least benefit to keeping it cached if we assume locality is true. And this is something we can implement, but it's kind of complicated. So one thing about it which is complicated is that we have lots of ways that we need to keep track of the actual ordering. And that's a lot of work because you have to have a list in order and adjust the order of that list. That seems a bit complicated to do. We can do it, but a lot of processors say that's not worth it. If I have like an 8-way cache, I'm not going to actually track whether in each set way 6 then way 5 then way 3 and so on was accessed. I'm just going to track some approximation of that so we at least don't replace something that's very recently used. Another problem is that even if we're using one of these approximations, we're doing writes to keep track of this bookkeeping information on a cache read. So suddenly something that's just supposed to be reading from the cache now also turns into a write operation, which is going to be more complicated in the hardware. So for that reason, some processors might say, oh, it isn't worth implementing an actual LRU-like policy in our cache. I'm going to do something simpler. And an example simpler option would be first in, first out. So here we just keep a counter saying we're going to put something in way 0, then way 1, way 2, way 3, way 0, 1, 2, 3, and wrapping around like that. Yeah, so we're only going to decide what to replace based on when we last modified it. Or maybe we say, well, to do that, I need to keep track of where I last put something. That seems a little complicated. And we could do an even simpler policy, which is just choose a random place. And it turns out that these policies aren't that much worse than LRU in practice, partly because, well, I mentioned we assume locality, but locality is never perfect. Like, programs tend to have good locality, but it's not like they ever have perfect locality anyways. So approximations are pretty good. Then we talked about doing writes to caches. So by writes, I mean the program is trying to write something. How do we deal with that in the cache? And there's two big decisions we need to make. So one is, if we look up in the cache and the thing we're trying to write isn't already there, what do we do about that? One thing we could do is we could say, well, the program's trying to write to that, let's put it in the cache. And this policy is called write allocate. And we don't have to do that. We could instead say, well, it's not in the cache already, why should I bother caching it? The program hasn't read it, so maybe it doesn't really need it. And this policy is called write no allocate. And this is a choice we get to make when we're designing a cache. Now, if we look up something in the cache on a write and find it's there, we're going to update it, because it would be really bad if you wrote to something and then read it back from the cache and didn't see the thing you just wrote. You don't want that to ever happen. So we're going to always update the cache. But there's a question about what do we do about the next level? We want to update it eventually. Like, at some point, we're going to stop caching the value and we better still remember the thing we wrote to it. But we have a choice about when we do that update. So one option is that we could update it right away when we do the write. We could just do it in advance, and this policy is called write through. Another option is we can say, well, that seems like we're doing things before we really need to. Let's do this write back policy, but we'll write it later. If we do the write back policy, we need to remember to write it later. So hypothetically, we could say, every time I evict something from my cache, I'm going to write it to the next level. But that means we're going to write a lot of stuff which never changed. So caches don't do that. So instead, we're going to record this dirty bit to indicate this is something where I deferred writing, but I need to update the next level or else I'm going to forget about a modified value. That the program like changed this value from 1 to 2, and we better not forget that, even if we get rid of it from our cache, because the program might at some point read it again. And we want to make sure the program actually reads that value. So after talking about writes, we started talking about average memory access time. So this is sort of a way we'll think about sort of evaluating cache design decisions, which will be one of our big topics today. And to think about this, we say, okay, we're going to measure for some program sort of how fast it seems like the memory is. And sort of like we have our ideal is that we have all cache hits, but in practice, like we're going to have some times when the value isn't in the cache. So the formula we came up with was we had the hit time plus the miss rate, how often something wasn't in the cache, times what we called the miss penalty. And the miss penalty is the additional time we need when we don't have a hit. And sort of in a very simple cache design, the way this might work is we might check for a hit. If there's no hit, we'll go to the next level. So the miss penalty would be the time to go to the next level, because after we check for a hit, we have the time to go to the next level. The term is more generic than that, because hypothetically, like we could like go to the next level while we're checking the cache or something like that. So it's phrased in a way which handles those unusual cache delays. And another way we can write this formula, which you'll sometimes see, is hit time times hit rate plus miss time times miss rate. And this is equivalent, based on our formula for what miss penalty means, to the original. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so take some time to talk about the quiz. So the first question on the quiz was asking where a particular byte came in a cache that we showed. So we showed you the cache, and we said we're talking about a byte 1C, and if you looked in the cache, we gave you the contents of the block, and it was, you know, 0F, 1C, and then 6 other bytes. So we're asking where this 1C came from, and this was in the row labeled 1, starting at 0, so it had set index 1. It was, we're starting numbering our sets at 0, it was set 1. And we had 4 sets total, so we needed 2 set index bits. So our set index is 0, 1. It was the second byte in the block of 8 bytes. So we have 8 bytes in our block. We need 3 bits to tell where in the block we are. That's the offset. And it's the second one. The first one is 0, second one is 1. So it was 001, and we had our tag. And we know that our address is composed of our tag plus our index plus our offset. So that's how we construct address. Questions on figuring that out? So quiz question 2 asked, what is something which we could access which would cause a replacement? So for this, we needed to have a replacement, we need to put something in a full set. And if it was not a full set, you know, there would nothing to be replaced, we just put something in an empty block. And for this to happen, we had 2 sets, the one with set index 00, the one with set index 10 that could be put in, and we needed to access something that wasn't already there. So the tag needed not to match. So for set 0, this means the tag needs to be anything but the two tags that were there, A20 and C20. And for set 2, it needed to be anything but the two tags that were not there, C20 and 33. So questions about 2? Okay, so question 3 is probably the one people have the most trouble on, especially since I forgot to mention a detail about how the arrays were laid out in memory that most people probably skipped over, but I should have mentioned because it's technically needed to answer the question. So for question 3, the main thing it was talking about is the write policy. So the write policy in the question was, it was a write through, write no allocate. And the result of this policy was that in this cache, writes didn't affect what's in the cache. If something wasn't already cached, writes wouldn't make it cached because of write no allocate. And because of write through, they always go to the next level, and we were asked to count accesses to the next level, so every time you wrote a byte, it would trigger writing a byte to the next level. And we had 40 writes in total, so there were 40 writes no matter what. Even if they were cached, didn't matter, we still had to write 40 things to the next level, because every single write went through, we never deferred those writes. So then we need to talk about the reads. So what happened with the reads? And for this, we needed to think about how do the arrays, we had these two arrays, A and B, how do they map to our 2-byte cache blocks? And the mapping I intended, but didn't specify clearly enough, is that A would be at an even address. And if that was the case, then this meant that A of 0 would be the beginning of a cache block. Because with 2-byte cache blocks, our cache blocks start on even addresses. And this would mean that A0 and A1 would be a block, A2 and A3 would be a block. And let's say A0 and A1 went to set 0, this would mean A2 and A3, the next thing would go to set 1. If, in contrast, A0 and A1 went to set 1, then we'd wrap around and A2 and A3 would go to set 0. In either case, they're never going to conflict in the cache, because they're right next to each other in memory. So if it was at an odd address, we have a weirder situation where our blocks include part of the array and part of whatever's next to it in memory. And we'd have a case where we can't actually store A0 and A3 at the same time in the cache. So if we have the even address case, what would happen in the scenario we said is that we're reading A bunch of times. And what would happen is the first time we read it, we'd read the whole thing into the cache. All the other things would be cache hits. So we'd have 2 extra reads. And the scenario for B would be the same. We'd have 2 extra reads, assuming B is similarly locked. So we'd read B once. If A was an odd address, we'd end up with a weirder scenario where we'd have to sort of read A0, then read A2, A3, then read A0, then read A3, because every time we read A0, it would get rid of A3. Every time we read A3, it would get rid of A0. We'd have 2 extra reads in every cycle and plus an extra read in the first one. So the possibilities I got for answers were flexible. And we'll accept any of these as a single answer. So most people chose the first one because you assume, why would we ever put the array at an odd address? And indeed, this is something that compilers will try to avoid doing. Compilers will try to have arrays be at the starts of cache blocks when that's easy to do, precisely because of this kind of issue. So questions about quiz question 3? So quiz question 4 asked about a cache and counting the number of cabinets. So it was a 4-meg cache. And remember, cache sizes are the number of data bits. So there was 2 to the 22 bytes. We had 64 byte blocks, and it was four-way. So this is four-way. So if we wanted to compute the number of sets, well, we had 4 ways times 64 byte blocks. So that's the number of bytes per set. We divide the total number of bytes by that. We got that there's 2 to the 14 sets, which means there's 14 set index bits. And we had 6 block offset bits, so we had 44 tag bits and an address we looked up in this cache. And we store the tag along with every block, because we have to track every block separately where it came from using the tag. So you need to know the number of blocks. When we can compute that is we know the number of sets. And there's 4 blocks per set, because it's 4 ways. So we get 2 to the 16 blocks, and we multiply 44 by 2 to the 16, we get the total number of tag bits in the cache. So you can see that this cache has, you know, almost 3 megabits of storage just for metadata. That's just happens. Questions? Okay, then question 5 and 6 were asking about counting valid and dirty bits. So we said we had this cache, it was initially empty, and we wanted to know what happened to the valid and dirty bits. And the pattern we have here is I just looked at each access, I figured out where it went in the cache, and what would happen as a result. So we had our first write here, I figured out the set and the tag. So this is going to be added to the cache because it's write allocate. And it's going to be marked as dirty because it's write back. So we aren't going to write it immediately to the next level. So this adds a valid and dirty bit. Our second access was the same set and tag. So it's going to be a hit. It's already in the cache from the previous access. So it's not going to change anything. It would mark it as dirty if it wasn't already, but it already is. And the read, similarly, already in the cache, not going to change anything. Then we have a read to a different set. That's going to add a valid bit. We're going to read it in. It's not a set we've used before, so there's no worry about replacement. Another such read. And, I marked this wrong on the slide. A write. That's going to mark something as in a different set, which is going to mark something as valid and dirty again. And then we have a read to the same set as that previous write. You might say, is there replacement? Well, it's 4 ways. So no, we haven't run out of spaces yet in our set. So it's just an extra valid bit. And I count up, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, hopefully 5. Did I just write the wrong number here? Yes, yes I did. I have 5 because I can count valid bits and 2 dirty bits. Questions, how I figured that out. Work through this. Okay, so last time we were talking about average memory access time. We get through this example, thinking about single cache. And one thing the average memory access time sort of idea helps us understand is why do we have multiple levels of cache? Why don't we just make one single cache? Like, what's the advantage of having multiple levels of cache? And to consider that, let's think of doing an average memory access time calculation for a 2-level cache system. So here I have an L1 cache, has a 3-cycle hit time, and we have a 90% hit rate. And I have an L2 cache with a 10-cycle hit time, and an 80% hit rate. You might say, wait a moment, how is the L2 less good than the L1? So this 80% is only for accesses which make it past the level 1 cache. And these generally, in practice, will be kind of harder to make hits because we've already handled the easy cases in the level 1. And we have main memory with 100 cycle access time. And let's assume that the way this cache works is that we have to take the whole hit time before we go to the next level. So if I have an access that needs to go to the L2 but not but not main memory. What's going to happen is first, I'm going to take 3 cycles to figure out it's not in the level 1. Then I'm going to take 10 cycles to get it from the L2. And I have an access to main memory. I'm going to first take 3 cycles to figure out it's not in the level 1. Then I'm going to take 10 cycles to figure out it's not in the level 2. Then I'm going to take 100 cycles to get it from main memory. So let's assume that. That's not always how real caches work. Sometimes they can cut down the time a little bit, but it's pretty close. Usually you have to spend most of the time for a hit before you actually contact the next level, because it doesn't make sense to like send every access to the level 2 that's less efficient right away. Question is, what's our average memory access time for this cache? Share with your neighbors if you're nearby somewhere. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so someone want to volunteer an answer? Yeah. 5.5, how did you get that?
I got it by, so 90%
Okay.
10%
will be everything else. So you said 90% is going to be 3 cycles because this is our hit rate. Okay?
Right.
And 10% is going to be whatever else happens.
Yeah. So okay. Within that 10%, 80% of total will be
10
cycles.
Okay. So 80% of this is 10, you say? Okay. And 20% of that, which is 2% total, will be 100. Okay, so this is right, except that we have to take this into account. So this would be right, assuming that when we had an access, we went to the L2 and L1 at the same time, which is indeed something we could do. The problem is that would probably overload the L2 if we actually did that. So the assumption in this question that we made is I assume we take the whole hit time. And you might say, do we really need to do that? Couldn't we like figure out it's going to miss earlier? And often we can. So some caches will have something that's kind of in between your answer and my answer in practice. So the adjustment we make is that you said, oh, if it's a miss but uses the L3, it takes 10 cycles, so it's going to be 10 plus 3 because first we have to wait for the L1. And maybe we could have a design where we contact the L2 earlier. Some processors do this. And it might be something like 10 plus 2 or something like that. Maybe we somehow figure out it's a miss earlier, figure out it's probably a miss earlier. And for the 100, the same sort of thing. We're going to assume this is 100 plus 10 plus 3. But indeed, like maybe some cache could be clever and get and like cut down that 10 plus 3 to something smaller. So it's 6, yes. So this ends up being 6 if you do the calculation. And yeah, we're making this assumption that we have to do the whole hit time before we move on to the next level. In practice, it's somewhere, especially for the L2, it might be it's likely to be a little better than that. That maybe we can figure out, we can design a level 2 a cache so we can figure out that we have a miss a little earlier for a large cache. Okay. And I calculated this instead of doing the hit time times hit rate plus miss time times miss rate. I did hit time plus miss rate times miss penalty calculation, which is more straightforward with this assumption. Would be less straightforward if we weren't making that assumption. So questions? Can you do this? Yes.
So with that formula, do you not have to the 10 plus 3?
Question with the alternate formula, do I have to do the 10 plus 3? Yes, and this is because, remember, the miss penalty is already sort of subtracting the hit timeout. Does that answer your question? Okay. But I guess if I were using this formula, but I said, oh, on a miss, like that starts the access like, you know, 2/3 of the way in, it would be a lot more complicated. So that's our training system. And you can see from this that having this second level of a cache sort of allows us to control the sort of overall access time in ways which are hard to do by making even pretty large adjustments to the performance of our first level. That if we had only main memory, we can sort of do the substitute calculation of this would be plus 100. 0.1 times 100, and that would be 13 cycles. So there are level 2 cache that only works 80% of the time, saved us a lot of time. And a lot of time compared to even very aggressive things we could do to the level 1 cache. It saved us more time probably than making the level 1 cache go to 95% hit rate, which is actually a lot of work. Okay, so we're talking about cache design. So we have this formula, and another thing we want to think about is, when we're thinking about how a program accesses memory, there's different types of reasons why caches do poorly on a program's memory access. So a common thing we might do is try to categorize the program's cache misses to figure out sort of what the reason for them is. And a common categorization is that we'll call some of these compulsory or cold misses. So the first time we're accessing something, if it hasn't been accessed before, it obviously can't be a cache-in, or at least so far, it can't be a cache-in. So we call these compulsory because, like, we're not going to fix this cache miss by making our cache bigger, for example. That's not going to solve the problem because, you know, no matter how big our cache is, it can't have things that haven't been read into it. We also have conflict misses. So conflict misses are what we're going to say are cases where, you know, we could have stored it in the cache, like it was accessed before, but it got evicted, not because we ran out of space really, but because we had to put it in the same set as something else. And because we didn't have enough flexibility, we, you know, overwrote it for that reason. So like this is in our direct map cache when we have two things that map to the same set. This is a conflict miss. And often when that happens, we could have stored it somewhere else in the cache and that would have been fine. And the way I would sort of define what a conflict miss is that if we imagine having a fully associative cache, that it could clearly have done better. So if we didn't have to put it in a particular set, if we could put everything everywhere, we could have made this work. So a fully associated cache with the same amount of storage, same block size, that would have done better, that would have solved the problem, that's a conflict miss. Finally, we have the capacity miss problem. This is where, even if we had sort of that full flexibility, we just couldn't keep everything in memory, in the cache rather, because there's too much stuff. Like if we're accessing all of a 4 meg array and we have a 2 meg cache, we're gonna have a bunch of capacity misses because there's just no way, no matter how clever we are about assigning, you know, each block to a place in the cache, there's no way we're gonna keep that whole thing in there. So we're gonna have most of it not be in the cache a lot of the time. So I'm not gonna have you do much sort of, is this a conflict or capacity miss? Because it's actually a little fuzzy exactly which, but thinking about things this way and trying to categorize this miss this way is useful because there's different changes we want to make to caches to solve these different miss types. So for example, if we know most of our misses are conflict misses, like that tells us if we have more associativity, our cache will do better. If most of our misses are capacity misses, that tells us our cache is probably too small. Like we shouldn't try to play around with changing the associativity and so on. If we have a lot of compulsory misses, that tells us we probably shouldn't just make the cache bigger and expect to get much out of that or change the associativity. That's not gonna solve the problem. And you might say, well, can we actually do anything about compulsory misses? Like it seems like we can't. But it turns out we can. So there's two issues. So one issue is that we're kind of assuming here in these definitions that the block size is fixed. If we change the block size to make it larger, we'll have fewer compulsory misses because we're bringing in more stuff at a time. And if we make it smaller, we'll probably have more compulsory misses because we're bringing in less stuff at a time. Another thing is that there are things we can do in our cache. There's a very common optimization real processors do that deals with compulsory misses. And this is called something called prefetching. So far it seemed like in order to bring a value into a cache, you have to have a cache miss. And many processor designers have observed that, well, we don't actually need to do this. We can instead get a value before the program accesses it. We can put it in the cache in advance. Might say, gosh, that seems like it requires a crystal ball or something. Like, how can we figure out what the program's gonna access before it accesses it? And, well, the answer is, well, we can do this a lot of the time. Not always, of course, but a lot of the time we can do this. And the reason is that you can, like, look at what the program recently accessed. You can make some guesses. So, for example, if you saw the program required us to load address 48010 into the cache, then 48020, then 48030. you can probably make a guess as to what the next few things it will ask you to load on. And this is something that processors, in fact, do in practice, is that they look for periodic patterns like this. They just have some simple sort of thing scanning for patterns like this, and when they see that, which is common when programs are doing instruction fetches or array accesses, they'll assume the program's going to keep going in that pattern and load some of the stuff afterwards in advance into the cache. And this is a way we can get rid of some compulsory misses. And this is done by pretty much all modern sort of general purpose processors. And so prefetching, so we just look for these sequential accesses, we bring in the thing that's going to be accessed, and if we're right, we avoided the cache miss, and if we're wrong, it might not be great. So if we're wrong, we might have evicted something to bring in the new value. So that could actually be really bad. But fortunately, when these sequential accesses are like such a strong signal and so accurate, that we're very rarely wrong when we implement this in practice. So it's not a big problem that, yes, we might evict something else. Because usually it's actually, we're putting in things that are going to be used. Some questions about prefetching? Okay, so, mentioned our average memory access time formula and our sort of categorization of misses. So this allows us to kind of look at the different ways we can change cache designs and decide and figure out how do they actually change our cache performance. And one way of looking at this is to think of the parts of our average memory access time formula. So this is assuming we keep the cache size constant, if that's possible. So like for increasing the associativity, I'm going to increase it by keeping the size constant. So I'm not just going to like double the size of my cache to double the number of ways. I'm going to double the number of ways by having the number of rows. So the size stays the same. So if we think of that, if we increase the cache size, that makes the miss rate better. We're actually increasing the size. Makes the hit time worse, that it's going to take longer to do an access. If we increase the associativity, that's going to make, and keep the size the same, that's going to make the miss rate generally better, that usually, since we have more places to put things, we're going to have less conflict misses. It's generally going to make the hit time worse, because now we have to check more tags in order to find something. And it might make the miss penalty worse. I think probably that's not much of an effect, but it makes replacement more complicated. Because we have more choices. If we increase the block size, I have that, well, what that's gonna do, the miss rate depends. Initially, having bigger blocks is gonna help us take advantage of spatial locality. Eventually, having bigger blocks is going to lower having bigger blocks, if we keep the size the same, is going to lower the total number of blocks, and eventually we'll just not have many places to put things in our cache. And this will increase the number of conflicts we have, and just decrease the amount of temporal locality we can take advantage of, because we can't store as much. So that's why I say it depends. Like, if we look at sort of the graph of sort of miss rate versus block size, like it's something like this. Usually there's kind of a sweet spot if we keep the size of the cache the same. If we increase the block size, it's going to make the hit time worse. Why is it going to make the hit time worse? We get a bigger block and we have to extract part of it. We have to read a bit out more stuff to get the thing we want. And it's going to make the miss penalty worse because I have to read more from the next level to handle a miss. If we add a secondary cache, that improves our miss penalty. If we do right allocate, that probably helps our miss rate because usually, well, because often enough, we'll write something and then read it back. If we add LRU replacement over some other replacement policies, that usually helps our miss rate. It might make our miss penalty worse. It might do something to our hit time because of the bookkeeping we have to do. And prefetching, I mentioned, will improve our miss rate. And we can do this sort of same sort of idea for other sort of optimizations or changes to cache designs we can make. And this is how we'd like use that average memory access time formula to say, well, you know, which parts of this are worth tweaking, which are, you know, seem the most important to tweak, and we can use these cache design decisions to try to change them, change those values. So I also mentioned we categorize misses. So we have a lot of things which we think will improve our miss rate. But some of them will improve miss rate more with some programs versus others. And looking at categorizations of misses from programs will help us decide like what's worth doing. So we can say, for example, that you know, if I have a lot of capacity misses, increasing the cache size is probably what I want to do. If I have a lot of conflict misses, if it looks like all my programs would run better if I had more associativity, I can say, well, increasing the cache size or the associativity are ways that will reduce the number of conflict misses. And if I increase the block size, that's probably going to increase the number of capacity misses. Why would it increase it? Because now we have fewer blocks. So if not everything is together, we can store less stuff if they're scattered about. It probably has increased the number of conflict misses because we'll have fewer sets. But it will decrease the number of compulsory misses because we're bringing in more at a time. And we can kind of look at our policies in this way, and the way we use this is we run a program, we try to categorize its misses and say, what's our problem with this cache? Do we need to deal with compulsory misses or conflict misses or capacity misses? And that would tell us what types of design changes could actually be helpful. Questions? Please. Categorization of our cache optimizations. Okay. And I think for reasons we'll skip over some stuff. Well, I guess maybe I should talk about. Okay. We'll just do it here. Okay. So we talked a bit about sort of that. And what people do in practice is they generally sort of simulate caches and figure out what actually happens. So for example, these are results from, well, a benchmark that was 2000 in its name, so it's from 2000. So these are old results, but someone, they just ran these programs in a simulator where they could change the cache. And they computed the miss rates with all sorts of different data cache designs. And this is the sort of way people designing processors will evaluate what sort of cache they want to use. So they'll use a simulator to figure out what's the miss rate with these, and they'll compare that to like how what will the hit time be if we choose this design, or will the miss rate time be if we miss penalty be if we choose this design. And they'll use that to like actually decide on the cache configuration they choose. But you have to have some program in mind because all these numbers here, what our miss rates are, is very program dependent. Okay. Questions? So our next big topic is going to be sort of understanding from a sort of higher level what makes some programs more or less cache friendly than others. What makes them behave well with the cache or behave poorly with the cache. And we're going to think about a lot of this from the perspective of if you're writing code and you want to take advantage of the cache, how can you do that? So let's start with some simple C code here. So my first question is, what data cache accesses does this function do? So I have a function here, I have the assembly code for it. And what data cache accesses does it do? I don't care about instruction cache accesses. I know it does a bunch of those, just the data cache accesses. Someone tell me one of them. Any one of them. Yeah. Read scale factor. So scale factor is a global variable. This is a, remember, this is a global variables label. Their label, which is just an address. Like it stands in for the address. So it reads scale factor. Okay. That is one of the data cache accesses it does. There's one more. It's a little more subtle. Anyone? Something that may have come up when you were implementing your processor. Yeah.
RSP.
So you mean the stack. So yes. So return needs to pop something from the stack, pop the return address from the stack. So those are our two accesses. We have a read of scale factor and a read of the return address. Those are our two cache accesses. Okay, so this is might be how this function's used, let's say. And in this case, we'd really want those cache accesses to always be hits. And let's suppose that we're running that in a loop like so that, and we have something like, we have these two addresses. So if we do that, we can look at these addresses and compute for some cache where exactly they are. We've done a bunch of this before, so I'll just, I won't have you try to take out a calculator. And we get, okay, we take these addresses, I combine them into my offset, index, and tag bits. I know that I have, this is 6 offset bits and 32 KB over 64 byte sets, which is going to give me a certain number of set index bits. And I do that calculation and I get that these happen to map to the same index. So I just chose some very inconvenient addresses here, where in our direct map cache, these would ping pong. These would end up conflicting, we'd end up having lots of misses because we had this bad luck. There, my compiler plus my operating system chose the wrong place to put the stack plus scale factor. So this sort of phenomenon is why we want a more than one-way cache, but also this is sort of how we look at, like, why is this program behave this way? Yes?
When you're doing the division, like the 32 over 64, I was just curious, do you have to convert, like,
yeah, so question, when I'm doing the division, do I have to deal with the units? Yes. So that'd be, so probably the way I would do this by hand is I'd write out that 32 is like 2 to the 15, and 64 is 2 to the 6, and that's much easier to do. Everything's inconsistent units when I do that. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. So these happen to conflict. And obviously, I set up that example, but this is one thing we want to watch out for when we're thinking about sort of how our programs behave, is are we going to have these random or not so random conflicts. Now let's look at some more interesting examples. We'll talk about C code. And this is gonna be, this is probably should us remind us of a question on the quiz. So here I have an array of 4 elements. And the array elements are 4 bytes. So this is a 16-byte array. And my question is, how many data cache misses if I have a one-set direct map cache? So this is a cache with one block, simplest cache I can think of, with 8 byte blocks. And here I'm just going through the array, and let's assume that even some and odd sum are all in register, so they don't use the cache at all. Check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what should happen here. Number of misses. And let's assume also the array is not initially in the cache, because that would be very, none of the array is initially in the cache. We don't have that help. Someone give me, I have an answer. So I'm saying 2, I hear, or? There's no volunteers. So some people, I've heard 2. Anyone have any other answers? Okay, so 2, I assume the way we come up with that answer is we'd say, we do this line, and we have our cache contains 0 and 1. Then we get to here, our cache is going to contain 2 and 3. And this is our first miss, this is a hit, this is our second miss, this is a hit. That's very reasonable. But I need to actually tell you how blocks map to the array elements. So indeed, if they map where our cache block is 0 and 1, great. It works out exactly that way. We read array 0, that's a miss. We read array 1, that's a hit. We read array 0, that's a miss. So on. There's also some writes, but they're all going to be hits, because we always write after we read. But this is assuming that our array starts at the beginning of a cache block. It could have been like this. In which case, we will have 3 misses. Or it could have been like this, which is still 3 misses, but in a much weirder way. Now, as I alluded to earlier when I explained the quiz, compilers and operating systems and like malloc implementations really try to make us usually be in this situation. Because while it avoids cache misses, it also makes a whole bunch of things more convenient. So usually they will try to do what's calling align values to avoid that problem. But it is something we need to worry about. Okay, so let's do a different scenario. And here, we're gonna give us the assumption that array 0 is at the beginning of a cache block. My question is, how many array misses do we have now? I've changed the code a bit, and let's assume that the compiler doesn't do anything funny in compiling this code. Please, like, it doesn't try to reorder things to optimize it or something like that. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have 2 misses? three misses. Four misses. Okay, no clue. Okay, so most people figured out four misses, that's what I get. So how did I get four misses? Well, I said here, this has to be a miss because we've never accessed anything. It's a compulsory miss. So that's a miss because we've never accessed anything. And our cache, after we do that, is going to contain array of 0 and array of 1. That's going to be our first block because we're in this arrangement. So that's one cache block. Then we access array of 2. That's not in our cache, so that's going to be a miss. And to bring that into the cache, our cache is now going to contain array of 2 and array of 3 because that's the cache block that contains array 2. We can't like choose a different one. So that's where we end up. Then we access array of 1. And, well, we used to have array of 1 in the cache, but no longer. So this is going to bring in array of 1, which we're going to do by bringing in the block of array 0 and array 1. That's going to be another miss. Then we access 3. We used to have it in the cache, but no longer. And we're going to have to bring in back in array 2 and 3. So we end up with 4 misses. Now let's do this version. Here, now instead I have a 2-set cache. It's still direct mapped, still only one block per set. But it's 2 sets. And also the arrays bigger. Question. Okay. In the first example, if array 0 is the beginning of the cache block, we have 2 misses? Yes. Who'd like some more time? A couple people. Okay, so let's see, who thinks we have 2 or 3 misses? 4 or 5 misses? 6 or 7 misses? 8 or more misses? Some other number of misses? No clue? Okay, so we had most consensus for 4 or 5. I get 4. So let me show you, I have this worked out. So first thing I want to think about is how does this map to our 2-set cache? We have 2 sets, and let's say, for sake of example, that array of 0 maps to index 0. We'll see that all the logic is the same if it maps to index 1. We just swap 0 and 1. Just assume it's index 0. That would mean that the next thing is index 1, then index 0, and so on. So now I know how things map, and I can sort of do just a direct, here's how our accesses work out. We access array of 0. We have to bring it into set 0, because that's where it goes. And then array of 1 is hit. I access array of 2. We have to bring it into set 1. It doesn't evict set 0. Then it's a hit. Array of 3 is a hit, and so on. And I can count here that I have 4 misses. So that's how I get 4 misses. So questions about how I did that? Now, this seems like it's going to be awfully tedious if we had a much bigger cache, but there's a way we can make this a little simpler to think about. So one thing we can think about is that we can kind of treat each set separately, because the accesses to index 0 don't affect index 1, because we never look in the, you know, we only look in one row of the cache when we're looking at index 0. So what I can do is I can say, here are my accesses to set 0. I can look at them independently. I don't need to know anything else about what's going on, because the accesses that use set 1 aren't going to affect them. So I can just say, if I access 0, 1, then 4, 5, what happens? And figure out there are 2 misses there. And in this case, I can say, gosh, the accesses to set 1 follow the same pattern. It's also going to be 2 misses. I have 4 in total. I don't actually need to write out, if I realize that they're kind of symmetric, I don't actually have to write out the set 1 accesses. You can just say, all the sets behave the same way because the accesses follow the same pattern. I can just do look at one set and sort of extrapolate. Or I could look at set 1 explicitly and sort of do see the same pattern. Questions? Okay, so let's do variation. Same set, 2 sets. Now, how many misses do we have? Would like some more time? Okay, cool. Okay, so who thinks we have 2 or 3 misses? 4 or 5? six or seven, eight or more. Okay, so most people said eight, that's what I got. So one way I can think of this is I say I can divide these up into our two sets. If we look at set zero, we have our, it's zero and one, four and five are the indices that correspond to that. And those axes are zero, four, one, five. So axis zero, that's gonna bring in zero and one. Axis four, that's not zero or one, it's gonna bring in four and five, replacing zero or one. And so miss, miss, and this is gonna be a miss because we don't have zero or one anymore. That's gonna bring in zero and one now. And this is gonna be a miss because we don't have four or five anymore. So it's all misses. And the same thing is true for set one. The pattern's symmetric in that way. So I get a total of eight misses. So questions how I figured this out? Okay. So as the slide said, these are the warm-ups. Because we're dealing with toy caches, let's do it with a more interesting case. So here I have a 4 kilobyte array. So it's 4 byte elements, 1,024 elements. And I have a 2 kilobyte direct map cache with 16 byte blocks. By 2 kilobytes, I mean 2 times 1,024 or 2 to the 11 bytes. And we're still assuming direct mapped. We're not dealing with this. And yes, and let's assume the array starts at the beginning of a cache block. So at. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so someone have an answer with a volunteer. Yes. 256, so how did you get that? Okay. So you said each block holds four elements, and I guess something we should state more explicitly is that the way we're accessing this, we're accessing 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So if we're ever accessing the same block twice, it's consecutive, right? We never like skip around. So the only way we're going to have hits after we load in a block is if we're accessing other parts of that block, and that's going to happen immediately after. So we bring in 0. That's going to bring in 0, 1, 2, 3. Then we're going to access 1, 2, 3. So those are all going to be hits after that first miss. So it turns out a quarter of our accesses are misses. To bring in the beginnings of the blocks, we have 256. So another way we could have figured this out, so you figured it out by saying, oh, we access every block four times, basically. So just the beginning of the block is the miss. That's one way we could figure it out. Another way we could figure it out is like we could say, how does this map to sets? And we can say, well, if set 0 is 0 through 3, then if we do some math, we figure out that there's 127 sets, and 512 through 515 is also set 0. And so there's two blocks we load from set 0, and the same happens to be true of every other set, that the way this works out, that we access every two things from every set. So what's going to happen is, if we think of what happens for set 0, we're going to access 0, 1, 2, 3 in the first two iterations. That's going to be miss to load 0, giving us 0, 1, 2, 3, and 3 misses, and 3 hits. Then, for our accesses to set 0, we're going to access 512. That's going to replace 0 through 3. Then we're going to have 3 hits. So we have 2 misses for set 0. And if we do the same analysis for set 1, we'll find out also 2 misses. Set 2, also 2 misses. Every set has 2 misses. We have 128 of them. You also get 256. So that would be another way we could figure it out, is we could say, let's look at each set individually, and we find there's a pattern. So we don't need to like actually write out each set. We just write out set 0 and realize, oh, every other set has the same pattern. And we're set. And we're done. We just say, it's that 2 misses times the number of sets, because they're all the same. All have the same pattern. We don't have any exceptions. Yes? How did I get 128 sets? So 2 to the 11 bytes divided by 2 to the 4 bytes per block gives us 2 to the 11 minus 4 equals 2 to the 7 sets, or blocks, and which is also the number of sets because it's direct mapped. Does that answer your question? Okay, so that's where I'll leave off today. Next time we'll talk a little more about analyzing arrays, and also a much more approximate and faster way of doing this. That's going to be more practical.